I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 16th of January. Our guest this hour says in his new book, The Great Debate, Edmund Burke, Thomas Paine, and the Birth, Right and Left, that it's not by coincidence that people who tend to agree with one another on one set of issues also agree on others. They don't seem obviously connected. There are exceptions, but conservatives and liberals fairly consistently find themselves on opposite sides of contentious debates on a very broad range of subjects, from economic policy to social policy to the environment, the culture, and countless other public questions. And he has been, our guest that is, long intrigued by the sources and nature of those distinct points of view. So he looked at the late 18th century, the extraordinary era of the American Revolution, the French Revolution, that together helped to shape our modern world. And he looks at the stories, the lives and times, and carefully considers the ideas of two people who may define, even now, conservative and liberal, Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine. Should be a really interesting hour. Yuval Levin is our guest this hour, author of The Great Debate. He is Hertog Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, founder and editor of National Affairs, a contributing editor to the Weekly Standard and National Review. He studies healthcare, entitlement reform, the federal budget, and was a policy staffer at the White House under George W. Bush and as a member of the staffs of several Republican members of Congress. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. I think we'll get a few of them this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Yuval Levin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So it's a really intriguing book, and very well written, I might add, very interesting.
Thanks.
Did you have to search long and hard, or did you have in the recesses of your mind Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine before you wrote the book? Had they always intrigued you?
Well, I would say this. The book starts, in a certain sense, from the mystery of today's right and left, from the fact that we take for granted that our politics is divided into these two broad kinds of parties, a generally conservative party, a generally progressive party, and that they're just at each other's throats at all times on all kinds of issues. I started really by just wondering why, but I went back to my own education in political philosophy. That was where I got my graduate degree in at the University of Chicago, and Edmund Burke, in a way, was easy to come up with. Edmund Burke is generally and often understood as one of the fathers of modern conservatism, and that's because he outlined a kind of conservatism that was not reactionary, that was not a sort of European throne and altar back to the past conservatism, but that sought for gradual change in society. From there, Thomas Paine is fairly easy to see because Paine was really Burke's most prominent adversary, intellectual adversary. The two of them knew each other. They exchanged letters, and most importantly, they exchanged published writings. They answered one another in public, and had a great argument, an extraordinarily interesting argument about especially the French Revolution, but in a deeper sense really about all of modern politics and what it's about and how fast change should come and what the purpose of it should be. And so they really open up one of the first instances of what we would recognize as a left-right divide. Mm. Obviously, it's not identical to mm-hmm. our own politics, but there's a lot you can learn about today from that period.
And would you say that today we have the same kind of political thinkers, even political activists, who are also philosophers, or were they unique?
Well, you know, they weren't that common even then, but we can certainly think of far more in that era, people like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison in our country, and Burke and Paine, Burke in Britain and Paine here and in France, who were not only political theorists, as we would think of it, but at the very same time, political players. I mean, mm-hmm. Burke was a member of Parliament for 30 years. He ran for office every two or three years the entire time that he was writing all of these great things. It's kind of impossible to imagine now. Maybe there are a few politicians in our relatively recent history, someone like Daniel Patrick Moynihan or somebody that we could think of who was of that intellectual caliber, but also a politician, but it's certainly very, very uncommon.
Well, it's also true that both Paine and Burke were alive at this extraordinary time, as you remind us, of the era of the American Revolution and the French Revolution. It almost calls for deep thoughts, right?
Exactly. It really drew out a lot of extraordinary people, both here and in Britain and in Europe. It was just a period of such enormous change and flux that it really drew intellectually serious people into politics in a way that's pretty unusual.
I'm always interested in the beginnings of people who become famous, and both of these men don't disappoint when it comes to their backgrounds.
Yeah.
Start with Burke, who had this divide. You know, it's even a significant divide today, but I can't imagine what kind of divide it must have been to have a mixed marriage, a mother and father of different faiths, living in Ireland.
That's right. So, in fact, both Burke and Paine come from religiously mixed families, and neither of them really comes from a place where you would imagine a great figure in the political life of Britain or America would have come from in their time. They're very interesting stories. So Burke is born to what we would probably think of as a middle-class family in Dublin. His father was an attorney. But as you say, his father was a Protestant, was an Anglican. His mother was Catholic, which was not unheard of in Dublin in those years, but certainly not common. And the divisions that still are very evident in Irish society ran much deeper then. And it really meant that Burke lived his life as a witness to enormous religious and social tension. He also grew, as he grew up, went to a Quaker boarding school, which means that all three of the sort of parties to the religious battles in British life then, the Catholic, Protestant, and dissenting Protestant sects, the non-official Protestant churches like the Quakers, were very much at odds and in tension with one another. And Burke, by the time he was 15, had gotten to know all three on a very human level. And I think what it left him with was a sense that these kinds of dogmatic differences become less important if people get to know each other, get to trust each other. He was left with a sense that life is much more complicated in practice than it is in theory, and that this was a good thing, that this is the only way we're able to live with one another. And, you know, I think that's reflected in a lot of what he had to say later in his life.
Mm-hmm. And Thomas Paine, kind of a quintessential American story of leaving England and coming to the United States with just about nothing.
Yeah, Paine was born to what we would think of as a working-class family, in some respects a poor family. His father, while always employed, was a working man, and Paine had very little formal education, though he had an extraordinary self-education in philosophy and in science, entirely by just reading books himself. And he became, eventually, after moving through various kinds of careers, became a tax collector in Britain, and became involved in a campaign to improve the treatment of the tax collectors, their pay and their benefits, and got into trouble. He ended up writing a pamphlet that was used to make the case for the tax collectors before Parliament, and it cost him his job. It cost him almost everything he had. He found himself bankrupt, living in London, and he was introduced by a friend to Benjamin Franklin, who was then the representative of the American colonies in London. This is in 1773, and Franklin got to know him a little and said, you know, you should try your luck in America. It's a place to start over. And Paine did just that. He got to Philadelphia and was determined not to start where he left off, not to start at the bottom of society, but to start where his intellect and his self-education could let him function. And very, very quickly, he became a prominent journalist and an important figure in the intellectual life of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about learning about both philosophies, perhaps it's a lesson to us, and it's good you wrote the book, because I think given what we have today with media that can be very, very partisan and people who are steadfast in their views, you are a conservative, and you say you're a conservative, but that it's important for you and perhaps for all of us to study how ideas move and to understand what the left is thinking and what the right is thinking. Both are worthy of our observation and our study.
Yeah, I think it's very important for people who are involved in politics, as I am in a tangential way. As you said, I'm involved in policy debates. I work in a think tank. I've worked some in government. I think it's very important to see that everybody in politics is motivated by a desire to improve the country and the life of the people of the country. people don't get into politics to hurt anybody, and it's very easy to lose sight of that when you're engaged in an intense disagreement. And so I think it's important to see where people's views come from, what they're rooted in, where they point to. And so one valuable way to do that is to study intellectual history this way, because the left and the right have always been with us in American life and have always been engaged in this argument about what is best for the country. And, you know, I think it's worthwhile for any of us to take both sides seriously and to look for them at their best. And looking at Burke and Payne is one way to do that.
Yeah. Let's start with the American Revolution before we get into the French Revolution. I'm particularly interested in what Burke's thoughts were about the revolution.
Yeah, so Burke was basically a supporter of the Americans, but for very different reasons than most Americans had for supporting the revolution. He did not believe that what was at issue was an absolutely fundamental question of principle, whereas people like Paine and some others, and of course Jefferson famously, argued that this was really about people's most fundamental rights being violated by the British Parliament. Burke said the Parliament has a right to do what it's doing. It has a right to tax the colonists, their British subjects, but it's not smart to do it. It's imprudent to treat the Americans as though they were second-class citizens. Instead, Parliament can work with them to find other ways to raise the revenue that it needs. And so he ended up opposing the government, the British government in the Revolution, because he thought it was making a mistake more than he thought that it was violating fundamental rights, which, of course, is very different from how Paine and others thought about it.
Mm-hmm. And Paine, obviously, a leader in the revolution.
Yeah, Paine was a very important voice in the revolution. Above all, a voice. He was not an elected official, and was not a military man, but he was a writer, and he used his talents, which were enormous talents, to make the case for independence. If most famously, maybe in Common Sense, the great pamphlet that he wrote that had an enormous effect on public opinion, he wrote the Crisis Papers, which were written while he was following George Washington's army around New Jersey and Pennsylvania. He believed that the American Revolution absolutely was about fundamental principle, that it was time to found a government on the right sorts of principles, which he took to be Enlightenment liberal principles, a radically individualistic way of thinking about society, but basically a belief that government needed to answer to the rights of its individual citizens, and that as soon as it failed to protect those rights, it was an illegitimate government, and the people had had every right to start over. And he believed that what had happened was the British had violated the basic rights of the Americans, and that the American Revolution was the first step in a wave of revolution that he thought and hoped would sweep the world, replacing corrupt and oppressive governments with free and democratic governments.
Mm-hmm. America has a fairly rich history of people who are not highly educated. Abraham Lincoln, of course, immediately comes to mind, but there were others. Yeah. Thomas Paine, and the British tradition is quite different. Can you be, at one point, you entertain the question that people have entertained about Paine, is he really a deep political thinker, or is he just a particularly passionate pamphleteer and agitator, which begs the question, can you be an effective deep political thinker if you're not highly educated?
Yeah. Well, it's a complicated question. And, of course, Paine in some respects was highly educated, but he was self-taught, and his thinking always showed the kind of rough edges of the autodidact, for good and bad. It made him creative in a way that people whose minds are shaped by a more formal education might not be. But Paine also was a spokesman for a way of thinking, more than he was an original political thinker. Burke, in this respect, is much more original. He really is a kind of father of a conservative version of liberalism, an approach that accepts the liberal society, but that sees it as the achievement of Western civilization rather than as a break from what came before, that opens the path to a kind of revolutionary politics. So a lot of what Paine said was thought and said by others too, though almost never as well as by Paine. He was an extraordinarily gifted writer, master of the language. But he was also a very serious person. He thought through the ideas. He wasn't just mouthing other people's thoughts. And he really, you see it especially when he answers Burke around the period of the French Revolution. He wanted to engage with these questions, to take them seriously, to see where they led. And he did some extremely important work that, among other things, begins to show you the path from a belief in radical individualism and individual rights to a belief in the need for government support for the poor and needy, which is a path that the left took in the course of the 18th and 19th centuries that becomes a lot easier to understand, I think, in light of reading Paine's thinking.
When you write, I'm intrigued by this, and I want you to explain it further, that Burke was both a reformer and a conserver of Britain's political tradition. Finding a balance between stability and change was the core of Burke's ambitions. Play that out in terms of the issues and how what he thought about them.
I would say one key to understanding Burke is that he believed that it was essential for people who wanted to preserve the best about the British system to reform it as problems arose, because letting those problems fester, leaving them untouched, would invite much more radical change. And so he believed that the task of what we would call a conservative, he didn't use the term about himself, but a person who wanted above all to preserve the best of the system that he inherited, that such a person had to be engaged with public policy, had to think very concretely about how to fix problems, how to address public concerns, in ways that used what was best about the system to address what was worst about the system, rather than throwing it all out and starting over on the assumption that you could just do better from scratch. And so one of the ways in which I hope that this book might be useful for contemporary conservatives is to push back against the kind of recoil that they tend to have from governing, from the details of policy. Burke shows us that for conservatives in particular, it's very important to be involved in the nitty-gritty details of governing, because that's really where you address problems in ways that make the difference between the conservative and the radical.
We're going to welcome phone calls. There's a lot here, as you can tell, so pick up on whatever piece you'd like. What's going on now between conservatives and liberals, whether or not it is indeed based in this time in American history, the importance of studying history in order to understand and be effective in the present. The author of The Great Debate, Edmund Burke, Thomas Paine, and the Birth of Right and Left, Yuval Levin, is our guest this hour. We're welcoming your phone calls with your thoughts and questions. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. The question of the hour is with a historical examination, an answer to the question of why there is a left and a right in our politics and who in large measure helped fashion the philosophy of the left and the right. And our guest believes that it is Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine, and the book examines their philosophies, their interactions with each other, and the extraordinary historical time in which they both lived. To your phone calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls and emails for Yuval Levin, The Great Debate, Edmund Burke, Thomas Paine, and the Birth of Right and Left, our guest this hour. Charlie in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Charlie.
Oh, a fascinating topic. I was just going to ask, how would your guest feel about these great thinkers of political science, how they would function today in a media that is so fast and rapid with the reporting of everything?
It's a wonderful question, and one of the things that's striking about the debate between Burke and Paine is, as I say, the direct confrontation they had, the exchanges of letters, the exchanges of essays. But what you see when you read those is there were weeks between exchanges. You would get a letter, you would send one back 2, 3, 4 weeks later, and that was expected. And so you had time to think, you had time to write. They would write drafts of personal letters, thinking them through in different versions. Obviously, that does not happen very much now, when a lot of our political arguments happen in kind of 5-minute bits on cable television, and that's different. It makes a difference, and I think it does, at the very least, mean that you don't have these kinds of lasting exchanges. It's very hard to think of a public debate between politically active people as opposed to between academics or writers that could look like this now in our time. It's good and bad. I mean, the immediacy of our politics has some benefits. It means that problems don't just linger there untouched for weeks, and it means that we are more responsive and more reactive. But it also means that there's probably less thinking going on, and obviously that's a serious downside.
And the essays that they wrote and their correspondence, would it have been something that the populace at large, both in England and America, would have also been reading and debating?
The essays, absolutely. The Burke Payne debate about the French Revolution was very, very widely followed. Burke's reflections on the revolution in France, which was his first great, I think it's fair to call it a tirade against the French Revolution, was extremely popular. It was one of the most popular books in Britain in the late 18th century. And amazingly, Payne's response to that, which was a book called The Rights of Man, one of his very best books, was even more popular, was certainly one of the most popular books in Britain in the 18th century overall. And they were both read in America quite widely, followed very closely. John Quincy Adams, who was then a young man but was the son of the sitting vice president, and himself, of course, a future president of the United States, wrote for one of the Boston newspapers a kind of running commentary on the Burke Payne debate over a period of more than a year. It drew a lot of interest, and because it raised a lot of very live political questions, both in America and in Britain, and raised it in ways that were very provocative, very well argued, very interesting.
Thanks, Charlie, very much for your call. Eleanor in Reedsburg. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi there. I wanted to make a comment about Thomas Paine's actual style of writing, which I loved. I mean, it was so fresh and so different than a lot of the formal writing at that period. Common sense, the language of it was just wonderful. It's still, especially the opening parts of it, are still just really great writing. And I also wanted to ask the speaker about Thomas Paine later. I can't remember the name of it. He wrote something. He went from being a hero to being really criticized for tackling organized religions of the time. And his story is really an interesting cautionary tale, I thought, about some of the trouble you can get into if you're a theorist and if you challenge things.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the name of that publication. It was after Rights of Man. And the final thing I wanted to tell people was that here in Wisconsin, there is one group that has celebrated Thomas Paine's birthday every year for 162 years. And it's a little congregation of old German Freigemeindes in Sauk City. And this Sunday happens to be the day of that celebration.
Oh, is it really? How fortuitous.
Yes, John Nichols from the Capital Times is speaking about something about the liberal view in honor of Thomas Paine's birthday, and it's the 162nd time this little group in Sauk City has done it.
That's quite remarkable. Thanks, Eleanor, for the call. She brought up a lot of issues.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. First of all, I had no idea that kind of thing went on, and that's fantastic. It is his birthday, as she says, coming up this weekend. So a couple of things in there. First of all, she's quite right. Paine, at the end of his life, wrote a book called The Age of Reason, which he thought of as a natural extension of his political thinking. His political thought emphasized the place of reason, of rational argument, as opposed to tradition and custom and habit in political life. And he then applied much the same kind of argument to organized religion. But he wrote a book that was very, very critical and very confrontational about Christianity, about organized Christianity, both Catholicism and Protestantism. And he wrote it while he was in France. The book was very, very poorly received in America. You can imagine such a book would be controversial even now, but it was particularly so at the very end of the 18th century when it was written. And it did great damage to Paine's reputation in America. He was a very close friend of Thomas Jefferson, but when he came back to America while Jefferson was president, just a few years after writing that book, Jefferson basically told him he couldn't be seen with him. And it took a long time for Paine's reputation to recover. In some respects, it didn't recover until after his death. So that even though he was remembered as an important and very valued figure in the age of the American Revolution, what he had to say about religion later in his life really colored the way people thought of him for quite a long time. And as the caller says, it tells you something about the importance of at least being careful in how you present your views.
And didn't he run into problems after he died that he wound up having to be buried on his farm because was it the Quakers who wouldn't bury him?
Yeah, exactly. So he and his will asked to be buried in a Quaker cemetery. His father was a Quaker. He himself was never a practicing Quaker, but he thought they would allow it. And they didn't. Because of the book he had written about Christianity, after his death, they told the executors of his will that they would not allow him to be buried there. He ended up being buried on his own private property on a farm in New Rochelle, New York. And not only that, but 10 years later, his body was actually exhumed, oddly enough, by a great admirer of his who wanted to take the body to Britain and build a memorial to him. The British government hadn't forgotten what he had to say about either Britain or religion and didn't allow the memorial to be built. And astonishingly and horribly, the remains were lost, and we don't know where they are. Nobody ever did figure it out. And so no one knows where Thomas Paine is buried, if Thomas Paine is buried. A lot of cautionary lessons in that one.
Yeah. When you talk early in the book about that people who are liberal or conservative tend to agree on a whole lot of issues, Thomas Paine is kind of a crossover guy in that there are some libertarians and others who really admire Thomas Paine. I'm wondering how much crossover there was for both of them, and if Burke had people who would consider themselves to be liberal people embrace his views as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There is some of that in both directions. Paine, in part for his role in the American Revolution, in part for the argument he makes for a kind of radical individualism, which, of course, in some respects is important to the left, but in some also to some on the right, especially libertarians. There are people who will pick some of what he says and leave behind other things he says and make him a kind of libertarian hero. I think that's not crazy, but it's not a full understanding of Paine either. Some of that has happened with Burke. Woodrow Wilson, for example, was an admirer of Burke in some respects. He valued his case for gradual change, but he did make Burke seem more like an agent of change than Burke himself would have been. You find people who argue for gradualism in general appealing to Burke because he makes a very powerful case for gradualism, and so certainly that sometimes comes up on the left. But on the whole, Paine is, for a very long time now, been one of the great heroes of the progressive movement, of the labor movement in both Britain and America, and is understood as a figure of the left, as I think he would have liked to be understood. And Burke has been one of the great figures in the intellectual history of the right.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about the French Revolution. We want to thank you, Eleanor, very much. It was a crucial piece of information, Paine's birthday and the celebration here in Wisconsin. And tell people that they are welcome to join our conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Yuval Levin, who's the author of The Great Debate, Edmund Burke, Thomas Paine, and the Birth of the Right and Left, is our guest this hour. In Burke's case, a leading question, you write, has been whether he had a consistent set of views throughout his life or whether the French Revolution transformed him somehow. What did he say about the French Revolution, and did it transform him, his views?
Yeah, so the question here really is, Burke, early in his career, as we talked about a little bit before, was a reformer of elements of the British system that he thought needed change in order to avoid a more radical change of the whole. And so he was a reformer of the criminal law, which he thought was too harsh and punitive. He was a reformer of economic and financial policy, of government spending. He was always an opponent of slavery, which in some respects in British politics then put him on the left, a very adamant and public opponent of slavery. And so there were people who were on the more progressive or radical wing of the Whig Party in Britain who thought of Burke as a great ally, as one of them. The French Revolution came, and Burke immediately, from the very first inklings of what was happening in France, was an adamant opponent and critic of the French Revolution. He thought that the radicalism of it was incredibly dangerous to the stability of society, that the French were doing exactly what his reforms were intended to prevent in Britain, which was a kind of throwing out of all of the inheritance of past generations and trying to start over on what you might imagine was a rational foundation, but what he thought no one could possibly know enough to start a society from scratch that way. And so he became a great voice in opposition to the French Revolution. Those Whigs who had been his allies in some of those other endeavors were very friendly to the French Revolution. They thought that it was a move in the direction of liberty, of British-style liberty. They thought that it was, in some respects, also a model for Britain, for giving people more freedom, for maybe ending the monarchy and creating a republic. Burke thought that the French Revolution was the very embodiment of what he sought to avoid in society, and he was an absolutely staunch critic of it. And, of course, that's where his debate with Paine was most explicit.
Mm-hmm. And what were his thoughts about an area that's always kind of confounded me, and maybe because I'm very Irish, but what were his thoughts about the monarchy?
Yeah, well, Burke was a defender of the mixed regime in Britain, and he always emphasized the mixed character of it. That is, it is a monarchy, but a limited monarchy, a monarchy with a parliament, the most powerful element of which was democratically elected, though, of course, at that time with a very limited voter base. So he was a friend of the monarchy as a source of stability, but he was a critic of the monarchy when it tried to overreach and get too involved in day-to-day politics. So again, early in his career, he spent a lot of his efforts trying to keep the king out of daily political questions in Parliament. But later in his career, as the danger of the spreading of French ideas, French revolutionary ideas to Britain became apparent to him, he was a defender of the power of the monarch.
Mm. And what do you think about the monarchy now, you?
What do I think? Well, yeah. You know, I'm an American, and I think that there's very little place for monarchy in a free society. But I think the British have gradually and over time developed for themselves a quite free society that has at its head a symbolic ceremonial leader. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. They've made the very best of their tradition. I don't think we need one ourselves, but I don't think it's incompatible with a free society.
Hmm. All right, some emails. Matthew says, today's conservatives don't seem to favor slow change and are instead eager to tear down longstanding institutions like Social Security and food stamps. He would categorize today's conservatives as regressives. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a very fine question because, of course, when you look at our politics right now, it does seem like the people who are very eager to transform things are conservatives, are on the right. And the people who are trying to preserve our existing structure of government policies and programs are on the left. I think that that's a result of the fact that the debates we have are mostly now about the nature of a set of public institutions that are themselves the embodiment of a liberal or progressive way of thinking. That is, the liberal welfare state, the set of institutions that we have had in our country from the time of the New Deal, but especially the middle of the 20th century, are institutions that in themselves embody a liberal point of view. And one of the big differences between Burke and Paine was a difference about how to apply social knowledge in the cause of reform in society. So Paine really believed that one of the purposes of government was to empower expertise, to empower a kind of scientific approach to politics that would say, we know what the principles are, we know how to solve problems, we have this modern scientific knowledge of society, and government needs to enable the people who possess that expertise to apply it. Burke answered that by saying that the kind of knowledge you'd need to improve social life is inevitably going to be much too complicated to be possessed by anyone in particular. It's possessed by society as a whole, and so it's put into effect through institutions that apply dispersed knowledge, institutions like markets, institutions like families, institutions like civil society, all of the things that exist between the individual and the state. They disagreed very adamantly about this, and in fact, Paine was an outright critic of civil society, of those institutions between the individual and the state, which he thought were just illegitimate power centers. A lot of the debate between left and right today is actually a debate about that, a debate about whether knowledge should be applied through institutions of dispersed knowledge, again, markets, civil societies, the family, or should be applied through institutions of consolidated knowledge that centralize expertise and make it real. And the debate about the welfare state is very much a debate about that. So conservatives do want to change the American welfare state because they see in it the embodiment of a point of view they disagree with. But it's still the case that what liberalism is after is a kind of application of consolidated, centralized expert knowledge to solve social problems. And what conservatives are after is an application of dispersed social knowledge to address our problems and concerns. And so it's still right and left. It's very much right and left. But because the left had some major victories in the 20th century, what the right is trying to do now is change some of our existing institutions.
Let's go to Ferdinand in Shorewood. Hi.
Hi. I was listening to the program, and I you mentioned earlier you wondered if there was any kind of a left connection to the and I just wanted to point out that if you go to the London School of Economics podcast series, it's their distinguished lecture series. There was a lecture made a few months ago by a member of parliament. I think he's Green. And he's actually pointing out that in a lot of significant ways, the modern Green Party in England actually has a lot more connections to Burke's philosophies of ecology and what the guest is saying about the dispersion of information. And how, basically, if you look at the modern Conservative Party and Labour Party in England, they're actually neoliberal parties. But modern Greens could probably take a lot more. Have a lot more in common with a lot of what Burke was saying about ecology, basically. I mean, it's funny how the Greens are kind of all about environmental ecology and the wildlife and the environment, but actually politically and socially, he was basically saying that they have a lot to learn from Burke, and have a lot more in common with Burke than they do with a lot of so-called left leaders today.
Hmm. Interesting. Yvonne.
Well, I think that there's a lot of truth to that, and that truth kind of, excuse me, I'm sorry about that, it moves in both directions. It's the Greens are conservatives in many ways. Their conservation is inevitably a conservative thing, and the Greens are worried about change. They're worried about how change affects society. They're concerned with, as you say, ecology. It makes sense that they would look to a conservative figure for some of their ideas. In a funny way, conservatives today are not very conservative about the environment. I think that's one of the ways that American conservatism is not particularly conservative. And at the same time, you can see a mirror image of that in libertarianism, which is a movement of the right in most respects, but nonetheless can find a lot, as we were saying before, that's very appealing in Thomas Paine, because it is a movement that tends to think in terms of radical individualism and that tends to have a somewhat utopian mindset about what can be achieved in society. So none of this is simple, but I do think that the basic dispositions of right and left tell us a great deal about how people approach political life in a free society. And those basic dispositions, when you start out and look at an inevitably imperfect society, is the first thing that strikes you what is good about it, and you try to build on that and improve what's bad, or is the first thing that strikes you what's not working, and you're outraged by that and want to uproot it? I think the first speaks very much to a kind of conservative disposition that you find in Burke, and in some, but not all, modern conservatives. The second, much more to a more revolutionary or eventually progressive disposition that you find in Paine, and in some, but not all, of the left today.
Fernando, thanks very much for your call. We have some lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. The question of the hour is, why is there a left and a right in our politics? And if you are on one side or the other, you probably have similar opinions to others who identify politically as being with you on the left or on the right. You agree on a whole range of issues. Our guest this hour decided to look back in history to find out what may have been the origins of this, and he didn't have to look too far back. He went to the late 18th century, the American Revolution and the French Revolution, and found two extraordinary thinkers. Well, he didn't find them. He knew they were there, but has written his book about how important their philosophies were and their influence, Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine. He's written about all of this in The Great Debate, Edmund Burke, Thomas Paine, and the Birth of Right and Left. Yvonne Levin is our guest, and we'll take more phone calls in just a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. We want to invite you to join us Monday at noon. We'll be celebrating the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in words and music. It's Wisconsin's 34th annual tribute and ceremony. It's at the State Capitol Rotunda in Madison. The celebration this year is We Shall Not Be Moved. Jonathan Overby is your host, and you can listen here Monday starting at noon on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Yuval Levin is here now, and let's go back to emails and to your phone calls at 800-486-8655. David in Milwaukee, Yuval writes, how did Burke and Payne feel about honesty in politics? Was it integral, or could it be bent to achieve a specific end?
Well, it's an interesting question. They certainly both say that that honesty is essential in politics, and I think in the way they lived their lives, they suggested that they believed that. As politicians like that, who are intellectually minded rather than just simply cynical and hungry after power, tend to be more likely to make genuine arguments and honest arguments. I think both of them fall into that category.
John in Milwaukee, hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah. I was wondering what Mr. Ewald Levin thinks about my feeling that, like, the Democrats and Republicans, the left and right, are like a controlled opposition, along with the controlled media, into a Big Brother mental system in America.
I'm not sure what you're getting at with that, but perhaps you get it better than I do, Yuval.
Well, I'd put it, I'd make a different point that in some respects is like that one, which is to say that one of the things you learn from Burke and Payne is, and that's still true today, is that our political debates are moderate debates. They happen between the 40-yard lines. They're not debates between utterly radical alternatives. They're not debates between communism and fascism. They're debates within the liberal society, and both Burke and Payne very much embody that. They believe in the society that that they had. It's very much like the society we have, but they understand it differently. They understand its purposes and goals differently. That makes for a politics that is more moderate. It doesn't mean that it's less contentious. In fact, in some ways, more so than you would find in other systems. But their politics, like our politics, was a set of debates fought within a set of shared assumptions about what people's basic political rights were, what the basic purposes and goals might be. And so that makes for a politics that's a little easier to understand and that tends to avoid radicalism. For people who find that dissatisfying, and of course there were such people then as there are now, it's a constant source of concern, and it leaves people saying the left and right are basically the same thing. They're just two versions of the same thing. I think there's actually a lot of truth to that. I personally think that's a good thing. We accept a great deal. We take for granted the fundamental integrity of our constitutional system, the basic rightness of our belief in human rights, and we argue within that frame rather than about that frame. I think that's one of the better things about our politics.
Hmm. How do you explain, in the context of all we're talking about this hour, the Civil War in America?
Well, it's a good question. The Civil War, in one sense, raised some questions about the nature of change, the pace of change. But the Civil War was also a question about whether, at the end of the day, society has to answer to something higher or not. And in that sense, both Burke and Payne believed that that politics had to be answerable to some standard of justice. Both of them were opponents of slavery, and I think it's fair to say that both of them would have been very uncomfortable with the sorts of arguments being made not only by the South, but by the defenders of the South and the North. And so people like Senator Douglas, who argued that democracy means you just get to do whatever you want. Burke, who, of course, believed in gradual change and believed in tradition and thought that we should take the best of what we inherit, nonetheless argued many times that it is false and dangerous to believe that people could just do whatever they want because the majority wants to do it. There mm-hmm. always has to be some standard of justice above politics. Mm.
Ted is next in Jordan. Hi, Ted.
Hi, this is Ted. Yes, you asked a question earlier about whether why is there a right and left, and I'd like to ask if it's possible that it's because there's been a slow development and evolution of altruism in some people, and so therefore we have some people that are concerned and compassionate about society as a whole, and whereas there's others that are more concerned about self-preservation. And it could be as simple, a right and left developed because there are some that are only interested in mainly self-preservation and others about compassion for the group, the whole, or the family that some data says is the basis for development of altruism in people.
Thanks, Ted, for the call. Can you divide
it
like that?
It's a question that different partisans would take very differently, right? You can make the case that the side that's concerned for the family and for the group is the conservative side, or you can make the case that the side that's concerned for the whole is the liberal side. I think you could plausibly make both cases because they're both true. So I don't think that the difference between them is a difference of altruism. I think both sides of our politics want the best for the country, want the best for individuals, want the best for working families. They disagree about what that means. They disagree about what is best and how you achieve the best. And you can learn from Burke and Payne and learn from looking beneath the surface of our own politics that a lot of those differences come down to disagreements about what it is that makes people happy. Should we understand the path to happiness as being about liberating the individual from obligations to others, from the constraints that others impose on you? Or is it really about enabling the individual to thrive within the large social systems that make up a society? That's a difference about how, but it's not a difference about whether we should be concerned for others, which I certainly think is a commonly held view, not only among the left and right, but among all serious human beings.
Thanks, Ted. Ralph in Little Suamico.
Yes. I started listening to this about 15, 20 minutes into the conversation, so some of this may have been covered, but, you know, there were some comments about the right and the left, and then once in a while libertarian would be mentioned. And one thing I find a lot of commentators on TV and radio is that to them it seems like right and libertarian are the same thing. Whereas, you know, if you would watch the debates when Ron Paul was in the presidential debates, you could see how very different he was than the other campaigners or candidates at that time. So I feel like there is a difference, and I think it gets blotted out. And the two primary things that make me a libertarian are military adventurism, which both right and left seem to approve of, and also the banking situation, which it seems like right and left both approve of. We had two different groups, Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party, which both occurred about during the meltdown in 2008. They were very similar, and then they started to divide, and pretty soon Occupy Wall Street became a Democratic thing, and Tea Party became a Republican thing. And I think they both had the same goals initially.
Yvonne.
It's an interesting question, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. Libertarianism is, of course, a multivariate thing. It contains multitudes. Different libertarians emphasize different things. Libertarians who care most about economic issues tend to be on the right, not because they agree with conservatives about everything, but because they emphasize those issues about which they do agree with conservatives. I think libertarianism also increasingly in the last few decades has adopted for itself both a less utopian approach to economics and a more organic idea of society, a sense that society is an emergent thing, that it's not planned by anyone, that it grows of its own accord and should be allowed to develop as it develops. That's a path that very easily leads to traditionalism and to conservatism. Friedrich Hayek is a great instance of how that works because he showed intellectually how those arguments are connected. And Hayek is—he would not have called himself a conservative, and in fact wrote an essay called "Why I'm Not a Conservative," but makes a case that is a very Burkean case for the connection between libertarianism and conservatism. But there are certainly ways in which libertarianism on social issues is radically individualist and appeals to the ideas of the left more than the right. And you find that on the social issues, libertarians tend to be on the left, as we would think of it, on abortion or on marriage issues these days. And so it's certainly true that our politics is not simply or neatly divided in these ways. But it's also true, I think, that it almost naturally raises a basic, as I say, division of disposition. Mm-hmm. And that most people fall on what we would recognize as the left or right in ways that have something to tell us.
Yvonne Levin, thank you. It was such an interesting conversation, and the book is a really good read, too. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. The Great Debate, Edmund Burke, Thomas Paine, and the Birth of Right and Left. Yvonne Levin YUVAL, Levin, our guest this hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour and to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up from National Public Radio, The Dark Side of Emotional Intelligence coming up.